High culture meets high technology at the bleeding edge of the radical right. Majority Rights Radio.
Welcome to Majority Rights Radio. Today we have with us Professor Andrew W. Fraser from Sydney, Australia. As you will shortly learn, he does not have an Australian accent, and that's because he's from Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Professor.
Hello, how are you?
So you grew up and received your education in Canada and the United States?
Pretty well, yep.
You went to law school at Harvard?
I went to law school first in Canada, then came down here, taught for a couple of years, and went back to do a master's degree at Harvard Law School.
Right. And then you hived off to Australia to live the rest of your life in exile.
Yes. And that's how it used to feel when I was first. Now it feels very natural.
Have you ever been back?
Oh, yes. I've been back several times. I spent a year back in Nova Scotia. I go back regularly to visit family and so on. Every time I go back, I feel thankful that I made the decision to come out here.
Well, I could talk about Canada for hours, but let's get into issues of more interest to all of our listeners. Yeah. Let me explain how I'm going to structure this. The first thing we'll do, having explored your background a little bit, is I will ask you some questions that have been submitted by the commentariat at Majority Rights.
Okay.
And then we can discuss the book that you're writing now.
Yep.
And I have some questions about that. So in these questions are in no particular order, and I'm not going to attribute them to the people who submitted them. All right.
Okay.
Darwin wrote that, I'm quoting, "This virtue, humanity, one of the noblest with which man is endowed, seems to arise incidentally from our sympathies becoming more tender and more widely diffused until they are extended to all sentient beings. As soon as this virtue is honored and practiced by some few men, it spreads through instruction and example to the young, and eventually becomes incorporated in public opinion. As man advances in civilization and small tribes are united into larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him. This point once being reached, there is only an artificial barrier to prevent his sympathies from extending to the men of all nations and races." Now the question is, the formation of the hybrid English nation you discuss was a function of altruism. Currently, mass migration appears at the invitation of civilized host societies with a highly evolved and publicly reinforced humanitarian instinct. However, it appears to portend extinction, especially when host tribes are less fecund. Altruism provides a fitness-slash-survival benefit in relation to tribes that are genetically close. However, as Darwin suggested, altruism is extended even to those who are genetically distant. Frank Salter suggested this altruism should not be extended to genetically distant people, or it is essentially suicidal for ethnies.
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile? Obviously, we could have started with Rorty, we could have started with Habermas, we could have started with Kant if we misquoted him.
Well, I think it's not accidental that Darwin would have that insight. I mean, it seems to me that this is, in a sense, the tragic flaw in the Anglo-Saxon character. It's a very Anglo-Saxon perception of the world.
Did you get that idea from MacDonald, or did he get it from you?
Which idea? I mean, certainly, I think MacDonald's notion that non-kinship-based forms of reciprocity are kind of uniquely well-developed in the Northwestern European peoples is an important idea. Certainly, I got that from him, yeah.
So did I.
But it's also true that it is even more highly developed among the Anglo-Saxons.
Really?
Yes, okay. I mean, and there's a kind of a Back in 1913, I think it was, a woman called, with a very wonderful name, Bertha Surtees Philpott, actually developed a kind of a theory about why that is. And according to her, the Germanic tribes, you know, around the time of the fall of the Roman Empire, really were organized around two basic principles, the one being lordship, essentially based upon, you know, that kind of non-kinship-based form of reciprocity, you know, the oath to follow the chief into battle.
Fealty.
And so on. And the other, of course, was kinship. But and kinship on the continent was very, very important. But when, with the seaborne migration of the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes, to England, those kind of kindred relationships sort of broke down, relatively speaking.
One minor
and
point.
So, yep.
Don't recent genetic studies show that, in fact, most of the contribution to the modern British genome is actually old Neolithic, like from Neolithic times, and not the later Anglo-Saxons and Jutes, that, in fact, they didn't overwhelm the native?
Well, I read a piece by, I think I actually got onto it on from the Majority Rights website, by a guy called Mark Thomas, if I remember rightly, who did a kind of a study on the sort of genetics of the sort of population in central England today, and found that that those kinds of, you know, the Germanic kind of genetic markers were very pronounced there, and native Britain kinds of things were less significant, and from which he developed the theory that actually the Anglo-Saxons imposed a pretty rigid apartheid system on the native Britons and so on.
So, I hope you will forgive me for asking you if this shows an artistic temperament in the Angles and Saxons. And when I say an artistic temperament, I mean they seem to have done a wonderful job in depicting Britain.
Very good, yeah. Okay, I'll buy that.
I want to beg everybody's forgiveness for that, and I encourage all our listeners to hope that I won't do it again.
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Another reader says, Professor Fraser, well done on surviving the gauntlet of persecution without once stooping to apologize for what you rightly said. That took a rare form of courage. Can I ask you what you are doing now, both in terms of your career and any activism you may be engaged in?
Well, I formally retired from academia at the end of June last year, and I'm spending my time now writing a book.
You were teaching for 20 years at Macquarie University?
Macquarie.
Macquarie.
Yeah, named after an early Scottish governor here.
It has nothing to do with the French word maquereau, meaning pimp.
Absolutely.
which we know in the form of Mac Daddy.
I don't believe
no?
so.
Okay.
No. No, I taught for almost 30 years at Macquarie. So yes, in law, and really became ever more profoundly depressed at the direction that you know, modern university is taking. So I was very happy to bail out and just live the life of an independent scholar now.
Yeah. What do you think the best medium-term and long-term strategies for Europeans are? At least those Europeans who have not descended into racial nihilism, those who oppose the annihilation of their people and oppose mass incompatible race-replacing immigration. To use the old cliché, what can one man do? And another reader actually seconded that. What can one man do? Your advice, sir.
Well, I guess let me put it this way. I mean, down here in Australia, I mean, there, you may have heard of the One Nation Party a few years ago.
Yeah, some woman ran it, right?
Yeah, Pauline Hanson. And it sort of crashed and burned very quickly, actually. Had a meteoric rise and even more spectacular collapse. From which I draw the conclusion that really, at this stage of the game, organizing in political parties is really not the best strategy. I mean, what it seems to me that what we really need to do is try to develop a movement of people who are concerned about the fate of their own people, in fact, their own European people, and sort of model ourselves in effect on other social movements who were really aiming not to change the way people vote, but the way they think. Think feminism, for example. And if you're, I'm probably a bit older than you, but back, I remember back in the 60s, the enormous impact that all sorts of just individual women were having on everybody's lives by just organizing their friends into consciousness raising groups and reading this and reading that, engaging in, you know. So I think that's really even ordinary people.
Consciousness raising groups. Now there is a fascinating suggestion.
Yeah.
I hope people take you up on it.
It obviously had an enormous effect on our lives.
I've got a fun question. How much significance, I don't know what this one means, but maybe you do. How much significance do you attach to the supra elites that remain hereditary and exist beyond the national elites? Here I mean the princes of high finance and even the genuine nobility. This sounds like Lyndon LaRouche question. I mean, it's odd. if you know who he is.
Yeah, yeah.
Does this have to do with the Masons and the British royal family and the Illuminati? I'm not sure.
Or the Jews or whatever.
Well, no, but it's written, he's not talking about the Jews. Yeah. He's talking about super elites, princes of high finance and genuine nobility.
I think our major problem, really is with our own Anglo-Saxon elites, which goes right back to the question we were talking about before. What is it? What is the tragic flaw in the Anglo-Saxon character that really makes them so prone to that kind of competitive altruism and so hostile, in effect, to any kind of racial or ethnic solidarity in their own people?
It certainly didn't affect Rudyard Kipling that way.
Oh yeah, okay, fair enough. I mean, but that, you know, really.
I mean, the question is, can it be overcome? That's the point. Can it be deliberately overcome?
Sir, go ahead.
How is it? Is it something that is so innate that it can't be fought, or is it something that people can get over with a little bit of the right kind of propaganda? I mean, you know, Alex Linder says, you know, if we had the TV stations and the media for 2 weeks, we could change everybody's minds, you know?
I think the problem is a bit more deep rooted than that. You know, I mean, it really does go back to that basic idea that Anglo-Saxons in particular really, I mean, to use an Australian expression, you know, I mean, there used to be this grape juice down here that used the, you know, called Clayton's.
Clayton's.
And its advertising slogan was the wine you have when you're not having wine. Okay, so Anglo-Saxons are like a kind of Clayton's ethnicity. They're the ethnic group you have when you're not having an ethnic group. You know, Anglo-Saxons really don't like to think of themselves as members of group. That was always their great strength. It was what made it possible for them to develop the law of contract and corporations and all of these sorts of phenomena. And it worked extremely well as long as they were kind of by themselves in northwestern Europe, or simply settling largely uninhabited areas in the New World and so on. But it's become a real source of vulnerability now that we actually have to live in competition, cheek by jowl, with other groups who have a much more highly developed sense of racial solidarity or religious solidarity in the case of the Muslims and so on. So, right.
I see what you mean, and I don't disagree in any way.
Yeah.
This next question is I'm going to paraphrase it because it's somewhat long-winded, but basically the guy's interested in carrying capacity. That is, he never sees carrying capacity impact becoming part of the debate over immigration. And have you done quantitative research regarding carrying capacity for Australia? This gets us into the whole ecological
capacity argument on a global sense.
And if I can just betray... Now, you understand, as an interviewer, I'm supposed to be evanescent and perhaps a little bit effervescent, like a mineral water that you don't really notice drinking.
Right,
I'm supposed to simply... You are the main course. You are the beef au jus, and I am just a little bit of mineral water. And I'm not supposed to actually... My personality and views aren't supposed to come into it at all.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I'm going to break that, as I usually do, which is... It's a pity, because I'd be a better interviewer if I was less... of an extremely strong personality. But nevertheless, you know, what can be done? My personal belief is that these issues around carrying capacity, overshoot, I'm sure you're familiar with people back in the, you know, in the 60s and before, Catan and Paul Ehrlich, limits to growth, all that stuff. I think those things are going to become very important very soon. I think Hubbard, peak oil, and I think that the ethnic issues and sort of civilizational issues that you're talking about are going to intersect with other catastrophic issues that are going to come up, and, you know, lifeboat issues and triage issues.
I absolutely agree.
So have you done any work on that? And for instance, how nice is it going to be in Australia when it's crowded with more and more immigrants from overseas at the same time that the crops are failing and there's a permanent drought?
I mean, this is a major issue. I mean, personally, I mean, I don't have the kind of expertise to make an intelligent judgment about the carrying capacity of the Australian continent, but others who have, very well-known figures, even on the left in this country, have said that the Australian continent can, at best, really support long-term 12 million people.
How many you got?
Well, pushing 20 now. But interestingly enough, the person I'm thinking of, a very well-known figure called Tim Flannery, as far as I know, never actually uses the I word in discussing these issues. Immigration just doesn't seem to be a kind of an issue. It's like, you know, or the Greens, you know, famously, you know, I mean, like, they just seem to be oblivious to the problem of overpopulation, even as we are in the middle of this, or hopefully approaching the end of this apparently endless drought here in Australia, which is really becoming extremely serious. And yet... we're still operating on the highest levels of immigration here, since even higher than the Labor Party back in the 90s.
Who's coming in? Is it mostly Asians?
Mainly non-whites of various descriptions and so on. Very large numbers of East Asians and South Asians and so on. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. By the way, you did study Rawls, right? His theory of justice?
Oh, yes, yes.
John Rawls. Speaking of carrying capacity, I wrote a little something on majority rights once that I thought was a clever argument against showing that Rawls' theory is incoherent, his theory of justice.
Yeah.
Based on its inability to handle triage, if you remember, one of Rawls' rules is that when we're considering a rule by which a just society is going to operate, it might be that the rule will have to increase inequality to make everybody better off. So it's not necessarily the case that inequality is categorically bad, but the rule, the meta rule is your suggested rule must, to be a good rule, always has to improve the lot of the worst off in society.
All right, yeah.
You remember that one?
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, here's the question. In a situation where you're deciding who gets in the lifeboat and who doesn't, in a triage situation, who's the worst off? You know, it's a quantification problem, like the cons antinomies have the same thing. It's like, what are you quantifying over?
Yeah.
Is it, who are the people you're talking about? The people in the society who are worst off before the application of the rule, in which case they aren't in the society after the application of the rule.
Yeah, right. And
I don't see how Rawls' theory can possibly apply to a situation where you have to choose.
Especially if we're supposed to be in the original position behind the veil of ignorance.
Right.
I mean, personally, I don't really want to be put in that extremely artificial position. I'd like to be able to make that judgment about whether the boat is full on the basis of who we are now in the boat.
Right. You know, I actually brought up Rawls so I could segue into Habermas and your book.
Yeah.
The book that you're writing now.
Yeah.
And I think the first chapter, I will tell our listeners that they can't yet see a projected outline of the book, but that I'm privy to it.
Yeah.
And
the book.
You're really going to like this book.
Yeah.
It's called Anglo-Saxon Anglophobia: Why Today's Anglo-Saxon Elites Fear their Own People and Betray Their Ancestors While Welcoming the World. And the very first chapter is Germanic Guilt Trip: Habermas and the Penitential Philosophy of Constitutional Patriotism.
Yeah.
And, you know, Habermas has a slightly different take on the quasi-transcendental nonsense squid ink argument.
Yeah.
From Rawls, but they're essentially the same thing. He uses this ideal discourse situation and not the veil of ignorance, but I think they're the same thing, aren't they?
Very similar, I think so, yeah. Although Habermas, I think, is a far more radical kind of figure in the way that he works out the implications of that.
Have you met him? Have you ever been in a room with him?
I heard him give a talk once at Boston University and so on.
Yeah, I had a class with him once, so I can. He's this imposing, heavy German accent when he speaks English.
Yes.
He's got a poorly repaired cleft palate. And he's very difficult to understand.
Yeah,
and but he's funny, and he has this secular saint aura.
Yeah.
In fact,
it
was watching Habermas that taught me how that kind of thing is constructed.
Yep.
Because of course people around him help him do it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yes. Well,
but,
that's why I'm interested in him and want to talk about him in the first chapter of this book on.
Right. So I want you to talk about that for 5 or 10 minutes, even though, you know, our listeners may not care about Habermas, but you do and I do, and that's what counts.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing about him is, I mean, even though I'm writing about Anglo-Saxon Anglophobia and he's a German, it seems to me he's kind of, you know, to use a joke that Peter Brimelow thought up, you know, he's part of Hitler's revenge, in effect. We won World War II, but Hitler is having the last laugh because Jürgen Habermas is really created a whole sort of philosophical zeitgeist, if you like, that has really captured the imagination of the, you know, haute intellectual culture in the Anglo-Saxon world. And the basic...
I must say, for people who haven't read Habermas, it's very difficult without a lot of background to figure out what he's talking about.
That's right. You know, but essentially what he does is give a very impressive to those who are prepared to absorb themselves in it, philosophical justification for the idea of constitutional patriotism that has become so embedded in the sort of public discourse. This is like
propositional nationalism,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. The idea that the state really should not have any core ethno-cultural, much less racial identity, and so we're all the host population, let's say in Australia or America, should be at most just one more ethnic group in a multicultural society. And you know, essentially, puts a lot of philosophical sort of firepower behind the kind of utopian project that is, the modern multicultural ethos and so on.
Utopian, yeah, and that, as in Erewhon, as in nowhere.
Yes, that's right.
It's impossible.
Yeah, well, it used to be fairly fashionable on the left to look down one's nose at Habermas because he wasn't as radical as we are. But actually, I think he is really one of the most radical figures. I like to think of him as the Marx of the managerial revolution. So.
He was always talking about Talcott Parsons.
Yeah.
That managerial stuff. Yeah. So, wait a sec. Did you just let slip that somebody hinted at me about this? You actually may have been a leftist at one point.
Oh, yes. Of course. Yeah. I went to university in the 60s. Yeah.
Right.
I'd have to say, even then, it was kind of a toss-up. I mean, part of the reason I was a leftist... is that I was sort of, I was sort of hostile to the whole world of corporate capitalism that I could see around me. And I would have been quite receptive, I think, to any kind of coherent sort of conservative or traditionalist critique of that, but there was just nothing available. You know?
Now you know why that is.
Yeah.
Because now you know that there is a position that makes sense to hold on the right, but it has nothing to do with regular conservatism.
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah, I mean the conservatism in North America, whether you're talking about Canada or the United States, has always really been little more than warmed over liberalism and libertarianism and so on. So there was nothing really to sink your. I read Conscience of a Conservative and so on back in 64 or whenever. Sorry?
Is that Buckley?
Goldwaters. Ghost written.
Oh, right,
thing,
right.
You know, but.
What was Buckley's famous book?
God and Man at Yale, you mean?
I don't know.
That's.
He's, by the way, he's. In his dotage, he's turned like he's done something strange. I can't remember what it is. I don't think he's. That's right. He's more against our position than he used to be.
Yeah,
Buckley.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, he's got a history at National Review of essentially dumping anybody who wanted to raise the national question. Be to like Brimelow.
Oh, right, yeah. Right. Didn't Brimelow work at National
Review?
Yeah,
yeah. John
and
Sullivan,
then,
Joe Sobran, all of those people got the veto very quickly. Yeah. Once they raised the forbidden topics and so on. Yeah. And it's ironic, too, because, National Review back in the 50s was... Really prepared to defend segregation and so on, but things turned around rather quickly. Because I guess, once again, there really wasn't a kind of an intellectual tradition there to anchor one. The whole anti-integration, the whole segregationist movement in the South... really itself never dealt seriously with the issue of race. They always wanted to turn it into an abstract issue of states' rights. And that really, in the end, they had to pay the price for their refusal to come to grips with racial realities. You know, once again, I mean, like, you know, again, this is this Anglo-Saxon hang-up. I mean, even the people in the white South who had the most invested in trying to maintain a kind of a racial hierarchy that they had found to be necessary through grim experience, were not prepared to defend their own racial issues explicitly. They had to turn it into their own version of constitutional patriotism.
Let's keep talking about this book. I'm looking at the outline. Yeah. There are four segments, parts. A diagnosis, look at ethnogenesis, pathogenesis, and then the prognosis, the return of the repressed.
Yeah.
The prognosis is absolutely fascinating. You haven't written these chapters yet, correct?
Sort of outlines.
You have a chapter on metastasis. Can the convergence of catastrophes in a crumbling civilization revive the Anglo-Saxon Volksgeist?
Yeah.
And chapter 11... it may not be 11, of course, if you change. Archaeofuturism, which I believe you get from Fay, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Classic Republican remedies to restore the rightful rulers and reform the character of a people grown corrupt.
Yeah.
I think it's very interesting that you're going to end the book with a look at archaeofuturism, because right now, I'm interested in a couple gentlemen. There's a guy named Constantin von Hofmeister, who I will interview next week on this show, and also national futurism. And then there's the Aryan futurism of this chap in London, Alistair Clark, who I hope to be talking to. Do you know him?
No, not at all.
But the interesting thing is that takes us. The whole idea of futurism, right, takes us back almost 100 years to England in the teens, or the early teens, when you had people like Wyndham Lewis and Pound, and I'm sure you know more of these names than I do. You know, the futurism, vorticism. You know, they had all these pamphlets, these parties.
Although future, you know, not that I know that much about it, but I mean, to me, the really important part of it is the archaeo part of it. I mean, it does seem to me, and this is what I found most interesting about Fye's work is that he really does want to get us to think about what is going to happen, if and when this kind of civilization. Where this managerial regime we are living in now collapses, as I think it probably and inevitably will.
If you read Joseph Tainter, if you read Catan, if you read Richard Duncan, I don't know if you're familiar with the Old of Eye theory.
Yeah.
There's a lot of... Look, if the amount of energy that a civilization has per individual to spend... doing the work of maintaining the Leviathan, the creature, the blind creature that is the civilization. If the amount of energy decreases for some reason, there's not as much food available per person, or there's not enough oil or electricity available per person, then the civilization has to collapse to a lower level of complexity.
Yep.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it collapses to nothing, but it has to, and, you know, the theory of that's been, I mean, Tainter, Catan, sorry, but yeah, it's going to happen.
And what may well happen, and indeed, I would say what we ought to prepare ourselves for is a return of a lot of archaic social and political forms that the modernists and the leftists have been telling us are permanently superseded and so on. And this has been
No. Do you realize what their claim amounts to? Modern, postmodern, sort of post-liberals?
Yeah.
What they're claiming is that, yeah, we are the products of over a billion years of biological evolution, which at every, in every generation, right? Think of the family tree leading to you, right? You're a descendant of winners at every stage, right?
Yep.
So that the selective process which built you didn't actually know anything about death because it never saw it, right?
Yep.
In that whole chain, going back to the beginning. And the reason that the selective process can end up with complicated organisms is because of selection. And now, suddenly in the last 150, 200 years, we've learned that this whole thing is over, that we have now repealed the laws which generated everything. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
What insanity.
Yeah.
Now, none of that liberal stuff works in a lifeboat. Mm. And once people realize that that's where they are, or musical chairs, right?
Yep.
Liberalism doesn't work if people bring guns to musical chairs and if the chairs start getting taken away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is why, so we may find ourselves in a situation where all the... the taken for granted sort of political platitudes of the modern managed democracy, universal suffrage, for example, simply are no longer tenable. I mean, it seems to me...
I thought you were going to say platypus.
Yeah. But, I mean, can you see what I mean? That in a world of increased scarcity and rising danger, I mean, the property qualification, for example, may rear its head again. So they're all indeed, and for me, I mean, this is really, I suppose, what I spent most of my career thinking about: just what is the contemporary relevance of the old classical Republican tradition, which, among other things, took it for granted that no one should be a citizen unless they had a solid material foundation upon which they could build their the kind of independence you need to participate in public life. And it seems to me that that's really what we should be thinking about restoring, that Republican tradition in the Anglo-Saxon world.
I can't wait to read it. When's it hitting the shelves?
Sorry? What,
when is it hitting the shelves?
Oh, well, I mean, as soon as it gets written, and I'm hoping within a year or so I'll be able to finish it and so on. But each chapter I find turns out to be more complicated than I thought. So, and it, you know, but I figure within a year. And then, of course, I'll have to flog it to a publisher. And so the short answer is I don't know when it'll hit the shelves and so on. Or indeed, if.
Well, now, I want to ask you something. We could actually record this interview again at some other time if you think that I have gone off on too many tangents and involved my own ideas and not shown you the respect and deference that you deserve by effacing my own, myself. No. I mean, I really do try to do that, but somehow I failed tonight.
No, don't worry about it. We're just having
a
conversation.
So I have from you an assurance that nobody should write in and say that I was bullying you in the interview, right?
No, I mean, I'm pleased to just have a conversation with you that other people can eavesdrop on. That's seems to me what we're
and
doing.
And who knows who may be eavesdropping.
Yeah.
We never know.
Yes.
But, you know, they.
Yeah.
There was an author, Thomas Pynchon, who wrote a large and basically unreadable novel called Gravity's Rainbow.
I have tried to read some of this stuff. And
I actually, I liked the beginning, but I remember exactly the page when I stopped reading. Yeah. But anyway, in it he says at one point, I think this is very clever, he said, the beginning of true paranoia is when you begin to suspect that they are also being controlled.
Yeah. That's a good one, yeah.
Now, if that doesn't stir the possum. Okay, now, let's just finish up on some lighter notes. So you're in Sydney, Australia, mm-hmm. with that monstrous, like, opera house thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the brush fires sweep through Sydney every year now, right?
Pretty well. You can pretty much count on some suburb in the metropolitan area being ablaze, yes. Especially now. I mean, the drought is really very, very severe.
Did you ever read... I read the most interesting book 10 years ago about the Cooper's Creek Expedition, which was the first expedition by land from Melbourne cross land to the north coast of Australia and
mm-hmm.
back.
Mm-hmm.
Very fascinating. Yeah. Now, have you seen the interior? Have you been there?
It's flyover country for me. I've been to Adelaide and a bit north of there, but never really into the heart of Australia. No, I mean...
You've never been up on that rock?
No,
Ayers Rock?
Or, no, it's a kind of a tourist... Every tourist who comes here sees more of those sorts of spots in 3 weeks than I have in 30 years. So.
I would like to have you back on and talk to you again.
Sure, anytime.
And thank you for being with us tonight.
No, thank you. It's been an interesting experience.